The setting is the Senate of the United States. The time, today, the cast of characters, Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
I see.
And scene. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, the 10th day of April. Good as always to have you here, everybody. The thing you couldn't see from that cut of Mark Zuckerberg and Senator Hatch at the Facebook hearing on Capitol Hill today was the sort of bewildered smile on Zuckerberg's face as he explained to the president pro tem of the United States Senate how his company makes money.
Senator, we run ads.
And odds are it is how Facebook is going to keep on making money. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. And I'll tell you what, if ever there was a story to get her on the phone for, who boy is this it? Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So look.
It's my day.
That's right. Today is your day. The business model of this company is not going to change, right?
Correct. And I think you actually heard that over and over and over in the testimony today. There were several senators who asked Mark Zuckerberg, you know, would you let me pay my way out of this? Could you offer people an option where they paid not to be tracked and have so much of their data collected? And over, he said no.
Okay. And therein lies the conundrum, right? Because the basic premise of this company is we will use your data gathered from all these connections to help ourselves make money. What did we learn from what Zuckerberg had to say today about data and privacy collection and how that's going to go forward?
You know, there were a couple interesting things about it. I think that you could argue, people who have been watching the company for a long time could argue that he was a bit evasive and even occasionally disingenuous about how much consumers on Facebook are in control of their own data or even aware of the extent to which it's collected and the extent to which it can be disseminated to other companies. In fact, I think, you know, you heard senators ask the same questions over and over about the volume of data collection. And it sounds kind of silly and obvious, but I think that just acknowledging how much data is collected and all the places that it can go. Remember, up until 2014, any app could connect to Facebook and get any kind of access to user data and the friends of those users. That's what happened in the Cambridge Analytica case. And the only thing that was against the rules was selling that data.
Right.
So that is all a really important thing, I think, for the public to have learned. That said, Mark Zuckerberg did say, sure, there should be some restrictions on how we collect data and how we notify people.
And we should say they started rolling out today, the company did, those little warnings you get at the top of your feed saying you could be among the 87 million that got scraped by Cambridge Analytica. I will confess I did not get one of those notices.
I did not get one of those notices. I've been looking all day to see if I was one of those people or not. I think it's going to get a little worse before it gets better in terms of people finding out how much information I think Facebook has revealed about them. And so I think that was an important line of questioning. And look, even the solutions that Mark Zuckerberg pointed out in his testimony are things that Facebook could be doing now, like not spreading privacy information over 20 different pages, which they said they're going to fix.
Right.
But that's been the case. And that's crazy.
Right. And they could do it now. Say that again, right? They could do it now if they wanted to.
Yeah. Well, and they could have done it all along. And I think that's the important thing.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. And one hesitates to make fun of our elected national leadership. But I wonder what your sense was of whether many of these senators, not all, because there were definitely some who asked pointed, sharp and informed questions, but many of them seemed not to know what they were asking about.
Yeah. And I think that there's, you know, there was definitely a sense that like Mark Zuckerberg is the T-1000 of the Terminator series and, you know, Congress is like old bumbling Arnold Schwarzenegger. But that said, it shouldn't be that hard for people to understand. And I think that as it's easy to say, you just don't understand how this modern economy works. But Facebook has spent a lot of time making it a little bit hard for you to understand how this modern economy works. And so I think sometimes they bumbled into the right answers.
Yeah. Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech, covering this whole story all week and the context of it. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
All right, talk to you soon. We are going to keep going with Facebook here for a bit because this does seem to be one of those moments that a big part of this economy might eventually hinge on. At one point in the hearing today, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham and Zuckerberg were going back and forth over whether Facebook has any competition. We're going to play that whole exchange. It's a long one, but hang in here because it's relevant. Here you go.
Do they provide the same service you provide?
in different ways, different
let
parts
me, let me
of it,
put it
yes.
this way. If I buy a Ford and it doesn't work well and I don't like it, I can buy a Chevy. If I'm upset with Facebook, what's the equivalent product that I can go sign up for?
Well, there's the second category that I was going to talk about.
I'm not talking about categories. I'm talking about is there real competition you face? Because car companies face a lot of competition. If they make a defective car, it gets out in the world. People stop buying that car. They buy another one. Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps to communicate with their friends and stay in touch with people, ranging from texting apps to email.
It's the same service you provide.
Well, we provide a number of different services.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Okay.
Well, it might not feel to Zuckerberg like he's got a monopoly, but one of the challenges that are going to come out of this hearing is how, if they are gonna, and that is a big if, how Congress might start to regulate Facebook and big tech, knowing what it knows now. Marketplace's Aaron Trank has that one.
It's hard to regulate that which moves at lightning speed. Vivek Wadhwa at Carnegie Mellon School of Engineering says even the creators of new technology rarely understand what it's capable of.
I don't think that Zuckerberg ever imagined that his social network would be used to hack elections. How are lawmakers supposed to be able to see this when no one understands it?
For example, the first texting while driving laws came about a decade after the first text. Look at Facebook Live, says Arizona State's Greg Zachary. It was pretty obvious when it launched that crimes could be broadcast.
Lawmakers only saw the problem in this after the service begins and problems emerge, particularly some murders get live streamed.
Or the mapping tool Google Street View, says Shoshana Zoboff at Harvard. It spurred hundreds of privacy lawsuits.
There were real questions as to whether or not Google could survive this global eruption. But in the end, they didn't eliminate Street View, they doubled down on it.
It isn't just that lawmakers are slow to recognize problems. Zoboff says Facebook and Google have been fighting regulation since the beginning.
What the tech companies have successfully sold our society is that technology is progress, technological progress is inevitable.
Today, Facebook. Tomorrow, killer robots, drones, artificial life. Compared to regulating that stuff, social media might be downright easy. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Washington State Democrat Maria Cantwell, herself a former tech executive, if anybody out there remembers Real Networks, she had maybe the sharpest questions for Zuckerberg.
Do you believe the European regulations should be applied here in the U.S.?
Zuckerberg said, yeah, basically.
I think it's certainly worth discussing whether we should have something similar in the U.S. But what I would like to say today is that we're going to go forward and implement that regardless of what the regulatory outcome is.
From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes up the rest of that story.
The General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, sounds like a remedy for insomnia. In fact, it's keeping European tech executives awake at night. Chris Green is a technology analyst with the Brightbee consulting firm. He says this is the toughest data protection measure yet, with a truly eye-watering increase in the penalties currently in place.
So you could see a fine in some cases jumping from 400,000 to about 300 million.
The new maximum fine, 4% of the offending company's global turnover. The measure is stringent in another way, says Green. It requires companies to secure a level of consent from their customers that's much higher than before.
You will have to specifically ask people, are you happy that from this point on we will be using your data for X, Y, and Z, including selling it or sharing it with third-party organizations who then in turn may sell on your data to additional third parties?
U.S. corporations could also be hit by the new law, even if they don't have a European subsidiary. Robert Bond, a leading London lawyer, says the measure is extraterritorial.
It applies to a business outside the EU if it is offering goods and services into the EU or monitoring citizens in the EU.
And for such American companies, he has a warning.
You can't hide in the US and assume because we are not in Europe, you can't come get us.
He predicts much closer collaboration between regulators on both sides of the Atlantic. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back home on Wall Street today, first of all, the trade war is off, you guys. Also, oh, hello, Facebook shares. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let me take a detour here from Facebook for a bit and get us back to our regularly scheduled trade war coverage. And the latest volley came from Chinese President Xi Jinping, who got conciliatory in a speech last night. He said he is committed to opening up the Chinese economy to more foreign businesses and products, which sounds great. Emphasis on the sounds. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
There's at least some consensus among experts that Xi didn't really offer anything new in his speech today. But Michael Pillsbury, director of the Center for Chinese Strategy at the Hudson Institute, says it could well have been worse.
It could have been a hellfire and brimstone nationalistic speech that China will never back down and China will fight to the end. And instead, he talked about continuing the reforms and opening up of China.
Xi said Beijing will increase imports, lower tariffs on automobiles, and significantly broaden market access for American firms, but he didn't offer specifics or timetables for many of these promises. Michael Herson is director for China at the Eurasia Group. He says the Trump administration's trying to reset the economic relationship with China. The negotiations and discourse between the two nations would have to be much more specific for any real change to occur.
It's really the industrial policies and policies related to innovation that are becoming increasingly intense in terms of the U.S.-China rivalry.
In his speech today, Xi specifically addressed Beijing's Made in China 2025 strategy and the country's aspiration to lead the world in technology innovation. He also said China would increase enforcement of intellectual property protections. But Claire Reed, a former U.S. Trade Representative for China Affairs in Washington, says that's complicated.
Because one of the problems with intellectual property theft in China is that the theft occurs and then it's extremely hard to get a remedy for it.
And at the moment, Reed says the penalties are nowhere near enough to deter the crime. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I mentioned yesterday at the end of the program that the Congressional Budget Office is out with its budget and economic outlook for the next decade. $1 trillion deficit starting in 2020. That's $1 trillion added to the national debt every year. And by the end of the CBO's projection, which is 2028, that debt is going to be almost equal to the size of the entire economy. More, really, if the Trump tax cuts that are supposed to expire are made permanent. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that is going to mean.
These deficits and the debt they create have been building over time. But according to the CBO, recent legislation really added to the red ink.
CBO estimates that legislation passed over the last year added something like $2.7 trillion to the 10-year cumulative deficit. And about two-thirds of that was the new tax law.
Benjamin Page is with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He says in the short term, this will have positive effects. People have more money from the tax cuts. A boost in government spending stimulates the economy.
What you worry about is that, well, things are going okay until they don't. So, yes, as long as we can keep rolling over that debt, the economic consequences aren't huge.
But they add up over time, says Josh Sewell at Taxpayers for Common Sense.
And that's without even accounting for, say, additional emergency spending and without really addressing any of the issues with the demographic wave that's about to crash into Social Security and Medicare.
That wave being aging baby boomers. The CBO points out the funding vehicles for those programs will soon have more going out than coming in. Patricia Tong is an economist at the Rand Corporation.
There could be sort of a reckoning that happens in terms of how do we rein in this deficit? Do we have to increase taxes in the future or do we reduce spending? One of those things has to give at some point.
A point policymakers are hoping doesn't come anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Parents are kind of in the situation where they are forced many times to buy these disposable diapers.
Two words not often heard together, diapers and technology. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go. Dow Industrial's up 1.7% today, 428 points, 24,408. The NASDAQ up 2%, 143 points, 7,094. The S&P 500 up 1.6%, 43 points, ended at 2656. Most of that on fears that the trade war is off for the moment. Shares of Bayer or Bayer AG rose 4.7% today. The Justice Department greenlit its deal to acquire U.S. ag biotech giant Monsanto. $62.5 billion is the price tag. Monsanto off 0.1% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.8%. 2.80, technically. You're listening to Marketplace. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect your lives so you can make better decisions. Well, here's your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across this country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can grow and keep getting better. Become a Marketplace investor today. Whatever amount is right for you, it goes twice as far right now. Give online at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We have been following the saga of the soon-to-be late and already much-lamented Toys R Us the past couple of months. The company filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy last year with more than $5 billion in debt on its books. But soon afterward, it did something that might seem to some remarkable, but which is actually pretty common. It asked the bankruptcy court judge for permission to pay big executive bonuses. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains what's going on with that.
Toys R Us couldn't pay its debts. So it might seem a little strange that 2 months after filing for bankruptcy, the retailer asked a judge for permission to pay its executives $32 million in bonuses. Mikey Fox is 47 and works at a Toys R Us store in Eugene, Oregon.
It did kind of make me mad that, you know, the company is in financial dire straits and it seems that it's okay to get that high of an amount.
It's not unusual for bankruptcy judges to approve executive bonuses. It happened recently with Radio Shack and Westinghouse Electric. This is kind of surprising, though, because Congress passed a law restricting bankruptcy bonuses a decade ago. In 2005, Congress overhauled the U.S. bankruptcy code, mostly the parts about individual bankruptcy. During the debate, some lawmakers criticized companies that paid multi-million dollar bonuses to their executives during bankruptcy, like Enron, WorldCom, and Polaroid. Senator Ted Kennedy spoke from the Senate floor.
Take a closer look at the examples of executives in some of America's largest corporations and see how lavishly they benefit while their companies went into bankruptcy.
Now, at the time, companies had a justification for these bonuses. They said the goal of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is for a company to shed some debts and start over. And it couldn't do that if its executives jumped ship. Lori Vaughn is a bankruptcy lawyer at Trenum Law in Florida.
When you have a distressed company, the loss of upper management can be disastrous. You would lose that institutional knowledge. So it's important to retain those individuals.
Senator Kennedy wanted to make it a lot harder for companies to award these retention bonuses. So he proposed an amendment that required them to clear some hurdles first, like
the company would have to show that that executive had another offer to go to another employer.
The amendment became law. But thanks to some crafty corporate lawyers, that wasn't the end of bankruptcy bonuses. David Skeel teaches law at the University of Pennsylvania.
What has turned out to happen is they're now reframed. And so instead of paying somebody to stay, which is essentially illegal now, what the bonuses do is they have performance metrics in them.
Like emerging from bankruptcy quickly or hitting certain sales goals. If a company meets those metrics, executives get a bonus. Skeel says courts often okayed these plans, and they became the new norm. And that is how the Toys R Us bonus plan got approved. In December of last year, a judge said the company could pay its executives up to $21 million in bonuses if it met some goals, like $641 million in annual earnings. Toys R Us says it fell short, so the company never paid the bankruptcy bonuses. But other companies in bankruptcy have. And Charles Kahn at the workers' rights group, the Strong Economy for All Coalition, says that means the law hasn't gone far enough.
Any other working American that fails at their job, they don't get extra, they don't get more, they don't get bonuses. And I think that we should hold the executives at the very highest levels to the same standards.
As for Toys R Us, the company's executives didn't go home empty-handed. Less than a week before the retailer filed for bankruptcy, it paid its execs $8 million to stay on board. In March, the company announced that it's shutting down entirely. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
There are consumer products in this economy that are wants, the nice-to-haves, and there are consumer products in this economy that are needs, the gotta-haves. Those who have a baby at home know that diapers fall very firmly into the latter category. Parents today can buy scented diapers, eco-friendly diapers, designer diapers, and pretty much everything in between. But one in three families in this country has trouble affording those must-have items. Kathleen McGrory is a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. She did a big piece recently on the opposing forces of diaper technology and diaper affordability. Kathleen, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to sound flip, but I mean it not to be at all. I never thought I would be doing an interview on this program about diaper innovation, but it's a big economic deal.
It is, and I never thought I'd be writing a story about diaper innovation, so we're on the same page there.
Tell me how it came to pass that you spent a while looking into this.
It's kind of a funny story. There was an editor at the paper who had just had a new baby, and she was stunned by the cost of diapers. So she tasked me with going out and finding someone who was struggling with that need. But from there, we started to have more questions like, well, why do they cost so much? And how do they work? What's the technology that's in them?
Right. And the upshot of this story is that the companies are basically incentivized to make better, higher tech diapers, not necessarily cheaper, more affordable for everybody diapers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that has a lot to do with the psychology of parenting. You know, parents want to buy good, high quality products for their children. And oftentimes they are willing to forego things for themselves. So there is that incentive for the diaper companies to really make good products.
Can we break this down a little bit? I mean, and without getting too technical and graphic here, right? They're the innards, the absorptive part, and then there's the outer sort of the parents' touch part, right?
Right, right. And both of those parts need to be incredibly soft. So on the inner side, there is a top layer. It's called a top sheet. It's a non-woven fabric that acts kind of like a one-way valve. It allows the urine to come in but not go back out. And there's an inner core, so to speak, that's filled with these super absorbent polymers that kind of suck up all of the urine and hold it there. And they can hold it in place even as the baby wiggles around or moves, which is also really important because you don't want your diaper to leak.
Yeah, no. And then you definitely don't. And then the part that the parent, like when you're holding the baby and you got the diaper facing your hand, there's a whole tactile thing there too, right?
Absolutely. Parents want that to feel soft as well. And, you know, that's kind of funny because that's not something that the baby really feels. So yeah. It doesn't really matter to the baby, but that's something that matters a heck of a lot to the parents.
So these high-tech diapers, how much is it going to cost me if I want, I mean, what are the brand names, right? Huggies and I don't even know what, but right? How much is it going to cost me?
It totally runs the gamut. If you're looking at a Huggies or a Pampers, those are generally in the neighborhood of 30 cents per piece. You can definitely go with the generic store brand, but oftentimes those diapers just aren't as good and you'll go through them twice as quickly.
But if I'm, struggling to get by, dealing with car payments and a mortgage, and now I have to every time my kid soils his diaper 7 days a week, eight times a day, it's 30 cents a whack, that adds up. What are my options?
I mean, look, you can try cloth diapering, and that was something that we talked about in the story, but cloth diapers aren't always a viable option for families. I mean, for one, some laundromats don't take them. So if you don't have a washing machine at home, you're in a position where you have to wash them. And that can be challenging if you're working two jobs. But also, if you want to drop your child off at daycare, most daycares require you to bring 5 disposable diapers per day. They don't want to deal with the cloth diapers. So parents are kind of in the situation where they are forced many times to buy these disposable diapers.
Are there public assistance programs, actually, for folks who need it for diapers?
Yeah, there are some, but not that many. A lot of people were very surprised to find out that food stamps don't cover diapers. That's strictly food. You can use cash assistance or welfare to work, but that money is pretty limited. We're seeing more nonprofits pop up to address this specifically. They call themselves diaper banks, and right. They try to provide diapers and wipes to low-income families. But still, the statistic remains, you know, 1 in 3 families is struggling with this expense.
Kathleen McGrory, she's a reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. Kathleen, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Final note on the way out. You have heard perhaps that today is what's become known as pay day. How far into the present year women have to work to earn as much as a white man made in the year just past in this economy. And that is true in the aggregate. Today is pay day. Once you break it down a little bit, though, it becomes more stark. According to the advocacy group Equal Pay Today, Payday for African American women is August the 7th. For Native American women, it is September 27th. And for Latinas, payday does not arrive until the 1st of November. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials added 1.7% today, 428 points on news that the trade war is off for now. The NASDAQ up 2%, 143 on the point scale. The S&P 500, 1.6% to the good, 43 points. NASDAQ ticker symbol FB, by the way, up 4.5%. Digital is Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote does digital video. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And, oh yeah, this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.